really was one of the first major real-time events where all the papers had gone to bed and you had to put it, you had to produce the news and send it to people over the internet.
That really was a landmark moment in a lot of newsrooms. So most of our internet staff had gone down to the Billy Goat Tavern for a few pairs. And the Friday paper at the time was put to bed very early, I think 9:45 or 10 for the Saturday edition, because they had to do the press run for the Sunday paper. The bulletin comes across. I'm in this little tiny room all by myself. And immediately I call down, you know, to the copy desk and say, hey, you know, are you guys doing anything for the paper? And they go, no, it's gone. You're it. Bye.
Welcome to the News Nirvana podcast. I'm your host, Nick Parker. The News Nirvana podcast features conversations with media professionals from across the country, highlighting our ever-evolving business models and showcasing the strong and effective journalism produced each and every day. This podcast is made possible to you by the generosity of Blox Digital. Blox Digital empowers content producers to connect with their worldwide audiences at scale and continuously transform to achieve their business goals. Contact Blox Digital today to learn more about how they can help you thrive. Connect with them at BloxDigital.com. Hello and welcome back to the News Nirvana podcast. I'm your host, Nick Parker. This week, we've got Mike Riley from the Journalist Toolbox and senior lecturer from the University of Illinois at Chicago. Welcome, Mike.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
I like it when I get a chance to say this. I love having former sports writers on.
It's many moons ago, but it was a good time. Yeah.
Our producer Cherry is lurking in the background and she always laughs at me, but I will stick to this. Sports reporters oftentimes make the best everything reporters.
We've had to do a little bit of everything over the years, crime reporting, business reporting. And I learned that very early in my career, you know, you're covering a lot of things, issues like steroids and things like that. And the great thing about being a sports writer is you learn to write remotely and on deadline and in very difficult circumstances. And the other thing that I thought that was really great about it is you write what you see and hear. You observe, you go and observe something and you have to describe it. And I always thought that was a great skill to have. And it translates over to news reporting and writing, you know, many different types of reporting and writing.
I think the one thing that it didn't help me, maybe just because I didn't do enough of those stories, when it came to like the longer investigative type things where you're gonna work for a few months on one story, that I was not prepared for.
Yeah, that's difficult, especially, you know, if you're covering a beat. My early days, I worked as a sports reporter at the LA Times and Chicago Tribune, I was either out covering baseball or, you know, the NFL or something like that. So in season, it's really hard to generate those enterprise stories, something that's really in depth. But a lot of times I'd be working on those kind of in the background, right, as I was doing my day-to-day beat stuff. And, you know, I really have a lot of respect for the beat reporters today, the handful of them that are left, unfortunately, is that they really have to, you know, feed the beast constantly through all the social channels and through, many different platforms, that it's become even harder to generate those types of in-depth stories. But the great thing is you're out on, out on the beat and you're running into people all the time and observing things, and you're able to gather a lot of information that maybe an investigative or enterprise reporter who just drops in every once in a while doesn't have access to, and you have access to people that normally you wouldn't have if you were an enterprise or feature writer or something like that.
Well, I'm curious about this because, you know, you started, as you said, in sports. You went on to be an editor in newsrooms. You helped launch Chicago.com or ChicagoTribune.com, right? I'm sorry, I got that wrong.
Trib, yeah.
And now you're teaching. You're teaching the skills. What kind of drew you out of the newsrooms and into the classrooms?
Yeah, it's been a weird path. And I always tell my students this, you know, where you're starting now at, you know, 21, 22 years old, isn't necessarily where you're going to wind up. No. I went undergrad to the University of Nebraska and covered, you know, Husker football, Husker sports, gymnastics, you know, track and field, volleyball, you know, the early days of Nebraska volleyball, which was a lot of fun. And that kind of shaped me, you know, as far as my reporting skills. But I was also taking news writing classes and you know, covered the legislature for a little while and things like that, at the school newspaper. But I was going out on internships, and I did some news internships and also, some sports internships. And, I found that, my quickest path into a large metropolitan newsroom was through sports. If I was going to do news, I was probably going to have to start, a paper probably the size of Indianapolis Star or something like that. But I lucked out. I was interning at the LA Times, and we had a group of sports writers that got up and left one day to go to work for this publication called the National Sports Daily in 1989. It was started by Frank DeFord and was really a fantastic publication for about a year and a half. And it folded eventually, and they all went off and worked elsewhere. I was an intern finishing up my internship in the newsroom, and the sports writer comes over and goes, but we're just going to make it full time. I just happened to be there. I was the youngest staff writer for 5 years at that paper. And it was tough, a lot of tough love. I was very young. It was working on it stories and competing against, a lot of writers, 10, 15 years my senior. But I learned a lot. I have a lot of great friendships out of it, too, over the years. But that really kind of molded and shaped me. But, by the mid-1990s, things started to shift in our industry, and I could see that happening. My roommates were engineers. They worked for like McDonnell Douglas and things like that. They were aeronautical engineers. And they kept showing me things, things like the internet, which was foreign to me. I mean, there were only a handful of home computers around at the time. And they were showing me some of the things they were doing with it. And they were using HTML to code up basic pages and things like that. And they go, this is going to be the future. Your newspapers are going to go by the wayside. So I was covering the LA Rams at the time. And so I left that beat because the Rams moved to St. Louis, and I had a year to basically just write stories, do whatever I wanted. I elected to go to grad school for 9 months at Northwestern, and I did a media management program where I was both in the Kellogg Business School and Medill. I'm kind of toggled between the two.
I don't know how you made that decision.
It was crazy. A lot of people thought I was nuts at the time. And one of the people, ironically, that really went to bat for me and made it happen was the editor of the LA Times Orange County edition at the time, a guy by the name of Marty Baron, who people should recognize that name. Marty was portrayed by Liev Schreiber in the movie Spotlight. Marty's gone on to have a hell of a career at the Washington Post and Miami Herald and all those places. And so he wanted me to go and do this and gave me the leave of absence to do it. And I later returned to the Times after my time at Northwestern. But my time at Northwestern, I studied under a guy by the name of Neil Chase, who now is one of the top editors at Cal Matters. And he taught me HTML, a lot of different things, on how to build web pages, but more importantly, how to think digitally. And the opportunity came up, ChicagoTribune.com was going to launch and they needed some editors to build it and get it launched. So, I left the Times and went to work, in late 1995 at the Tribune. And, we built that website with all HTML. We didn't have any CMS or anything. It was crazy, to think about that today. And we would go in, 9 or 10 in the morning, and I was a night editor and the sports editor, and I'd go home at, 2 or 3 in the morning. It took that long to move the site up to the chambers and make them live. It was really a crazy time, but it was a lot of fun. The Bulls went 72-10 that year. And, we had a lot of great stories cover. The 1996 Democratic National Convention was in Chicago. We had the Olympic Centennial Park bombing. I remember that. That was a very big night. It's a crazy night because they put the newspaper to bed and we suddenly realized our only avenue to our readers right now is through the internet. So it shifted, how we really thought about the news and things like that. And from there, I just wound up teaching part-time at Northwestern as this kind of a side hustle. And liked it, and they made me an offer. So I went and taught there for 4 years before leaving and going to the Washington Post. I worked on the national desk at WashingtonPost.com, left there just a few months before 9/11. That would have been my morning shift, the 8 a.m. and 8 to 5 on the national desk. And that would have been a crazy day. I often think about that. Had I not moved home to Nebraska, what would have happened?
Yeah, I want to. I actually want to go back and pick a little bit at you on the bombing in '96. So I would have been in college, during that time. Yeah. I remember, but what I really remember is that's been an example used of when we figured out a little bit that we can use this tool. It's not just, oh, the internet's new and we're all learning how to copy and paste code and do it. So I'm curious your perspective of that, because that really was one of the first major real-time events where all the papers had gone to bed and you had to produce the news and send it to people over the internet.
That really was a landmark moment in a lot of newsrooms. As far as the Tribune, it was a very slow night for the Olympics. They had a couple of track and field meets or track and field races earlier in the night that were done, you know, by 6 o'clock. So most of our internet staff had gone down to the Billy Goat Tavern for a few beers. I was left behind to kind of finish up a few things, and I was going to join them. I got an early night. We're out of there by 10:30, unheard of. And the Friday paper at the time was put to bed very early, I think 9:45 or 10 for the Saturday edition, because they had to do the press run for the Sunday paper. So the paper had gone to bed. They weren't going to replate for it, they had decided. The bulletin came across, I saw it on the news. We had NBC up in the newsroom. We were actually on a different floor. We were on the fifth floor and the main newsroom was on the fourth. We were up in a little tiny room called Room 500. It was across the hall from Ann Lander's office. The bulletin comes across. So I'm in this little tiny room all by myself. Immediately I call down, to the copy desk and say, hey, are you guys doing anything for the paper? And they go, no, it's gone. You're it. Bye. So all of a sudden my phone started ringing. It was the sports editor, the editor in chief, Howard Tyner. Some of the sports writers that were down there. Mike Conklin was down there in Atlanta. So it was Phil Hirsch, and Hirsch was a veteran Olympic and news writer, Olympics writer and news writer. And he was able to take and put together some very quick facts for us, and we got those up to the web. We also were able to get a photo very quickly of the area where the explosion had happened. And it was, a little out of focus, and things like that. AP moved it or something. It was just a real quick shot. We didn't have the digital cameras back then that we do today, or the cell phones to share them, right, the smartphones to share them. So one of the things that we really had to be cautious about, and this was a great journalism lesson as well, was making sure that we referred to it as an explosion. We did not know it was a bombing at the time. There were a lot of bad facts that were being shared over television at that point, all kinds of, number of dead and things like that. And, I kept getting calls and always had somebody in my ear as I was, updating the site, the homepage, and, the story that Phil had started, we kept adding on to as stuff came in from the AP. Other Trib reporters began to feed to us and other wires. As I began assembling the story and everything, I had to keep reminding myself, sourcing, going back to the fundamentals and ethics of journalism of, do we have this confirmed by a source yet? Because some of the early numbers had, more than 100 dead. I think it was 141 dead. But there was nothing, the coroner's office hadn't confirmed it. The other thing was, it was so early. How do you count, that many people and that?
Right.
So we had to be very careful, with a headline. You could say bombing in Olympic Centennial Park was explosion. And we stuck with that. I worked all night. I think I walked out of there at 3 p.m. the next day. We had some other staffers come up and help me as the night went on. They returned from the Billy Goat. I called down to the Goat and actually let them know. They saw it on TV too. They started to file back in the newsroom, and we started to get some video feeds coming through from WGN and other news outlets. But really, Phil Hirsch was the hero that night, because he was the one on site who was able to. Mike Conklin too helped him a lot with news and notes that were coming in. So we had firsthand coverage of it, not just putting up wire stories. But that was a big night, and I always remember, because I'd come in early that morning. I think I worked 30 hours in a row. It was outside of launch, which was 52 hours in a row. That was the record for consecutive hours in a newsroom. And I went home and I think slept the next 9 or 10 hours and came back the next night and worked. But yeah, it was pretty crazy.
Yeah. Are there things that are still, I guess, that you still pull lessons from that as you work with, I mean, you train current journalists, teaching journalism students. Those are the early days.
Yeah, the immediacy of the web is still what it was back then. I mean, right now we can share from our phones much quicker.
Right.
Push it out. I mean, yeah, really there. I mean, all I had to do was cut and paste something in and hit a button and it would go up to the website. So that immediacy is still there. And you know, one of the things I always talk about is taking pause of, you know, and looking at sourcing facts, you know, taking a big step back, kind of like I had to do that night and say, wait a minute, how could there be 141 people dead? There's not enough time to count that many people. Right. And you could see all the chaos that was going on down in Atlanta. So, you know, I'm like, wait a minute, some of these early reports, unattributed information, you know, bad sourcing. And I just had to sit back and kind of stay away from that and stick to what my reporters were giving me out of Atlanta and what I was able to confirm through the wire services at that time. And the same thing holds true now. You know, I have a next week in my digital reporting class, a long fact checking lecture where we go through and fact check photos, videos, and also how to confirm information. And, you know, some steps, I give them like 9 steps on how not to get duped by fake news on social media. And that's just taking pause, reading past the headline. Don't just retweet something because the headline looks interesting. Read it, source it, make sure it's accurate. I put them through kind of a little exercise when Kobe Bryant died, TMZ, some of their early reporting wasn't well sourced on that. They turned out to be right, but some of that early reporting wasn't very well sourced. And, you know, before I shared anything on the Kobe Bryant death, I made sure that it had been confirmed, you know, by the LA County Sheriff's Department through the LA Times and some other TV stations, because, you know, TMZ, you know, and again, they got the story right this time, but they missed on a few things because, you know, they go with something too quickly.
Yeah, I think that's a really good lesson. I was thinking about, you know, the time really where I had that experience was 9/11. That was my first and really the biggest time where I was the desk guy, you know, bringing in all of the stories, and whether it was our reporters or over the wire. I still had more time though to look at things and decide how to, you know, how we were going to package and present that news. Whereas obviously I would have done things differently if it were today with today's technology, but would I have waited to make the same decisions is what I was thinking as you were talking there.
9/11 was crazy too. I just remember how slow the internet was that day.
Right.
I just left WashingtonPost.com. So I went to their website immediately, you know, especially when we saw what happened at the Pentagon, and they'd stripped down their entire homepage because it wouldn't load. CNN had to do this too.
Yes.
Where it was basically just a couple of links, an icon and their banner at the top. The internet, we didn't have the kind of connectivity we have today. So it was running very slowly, even over Ethernet connection. My God, yeah, just waiting for a photo load. So a lot of the sites were stripped down. There was still, you know, that pressure of immediacy, I'm sure that you had on you, that I had, you know, because, you know, I'd be getting emails and phone calls from my editors saying, you know, why isn't this up? Why isn't this up? We don't have it yet. We don't have it yet. We haven't confirmed it. But, you know, sit tight. We're going to get it. And there, in those types of situations, you have to really trust your reporters. You have to go back to them, knowing that they know how to source a story, knowing that they know what news is, knowing that they know how to confirm things and fact check things. And, you know, good editors make reporters look good because they edit their stuff and make it look pretty and hold them accountable. But it also goes vice versa. And I've done both in my career, reporting and editing. Reporters can make the editors look really smart by being able to be out there on the front lines and make good decisions from the beginning. And if they're sending you better stuff coming in, that's better, smartly reported, it's going to make your life as an editor so much easier.
Yeah. I remember that you were talking about the internet connections. Luckily, we used all the photos we used were local reaction type photos because I couldn't get them from the AP.
Yeah.
And we just wouldn't download.
Yeah. Yeah. It was crazy. You know, back in the day, in those days, you know, we had to use a tool called Debabilizer to compress the images.
Right.
So people on 14.4 and 28.8 dial up modems could see the images and they didn't download, you know, a half inch at a time. I tell my students, you know, I go, you don't know the pain of what that was like, you know, and a few of them are old enough to remember when they were small, you know, mom and dad on AOL screeching dial-up modem and things like that. But I go, you know, you're really spoiled today with high-speed Wi-Fi and Ethernet cables that, you know, connect you instantly to anything. And, you know, anymore, you know, our attention spans are so short that anything that loads under 3 seconds on your phone, people are going to leave and go somewhere else. So, you know, that in those early days, it really taught us to think about file sizes and things like that. It's not as big a factor anymore, you know, with the high-speed connectivity. But it is still an issue, especially with mobile. If you've got too big of files, you know, people don't want to sit there and watch that buffer wheel go.
Yeah, if you're dealing with video, you are. I want to shift gears a little bit because, I mean, like any old news guy, like we almost sit and swap war stories forever, right? But I do want to shift gears and talk about the Journalist Toolbox, this newsletter and website you have. And it's the perfect name because it describes everything, you know, that you've got there. What you started it, you sold it, you took it back over. What really was the impetus behind this?
Yeah, the Journalist Toolbox goes back to, again, you know, 1996. I was teaching a news writing class up at Northwestern, and I put my syllabus online. Back then, we didn't have Canvas and Blackboard and all those tools to put your syllabus online. So I just created a little web page. So the students could go in, find the syllabus, find all the resources they needed for each week of class. And one of the things we had was, it was just called Toolbox. It was just one word, Toolbox. And it had 10 links on it, opensecrets.org, Congressional Quarterly, a few crime databases, a few other things that we used in class. And, you know, over the next several quarters and semesters, students would come back from internships and say, hey, have you seen this site? Or, you know, so I started to add stuff to it. It was, again, just a single page and wound up being hundreds of links after a while. And once I left there and I was working at WashingtonPost.com, I would walk around the newsroom. I was the liaison between the two offices for a little while. We worked online in over in Vienna, Virginia. And I would take the train over down to K Street, down where the Post was at the time, and the main office. And so I'd sit in on meetings there and then go back and forth, ride the metro back and forth. And as I'd walk through the newsroom, sometimes I'd see the page up on reporters' computers. And so I'd walk over to them. I go, you know, how'd you find this? Oh, yeah, it showed up in Yahoo search or something like that in the early days of Google, too.
Right.
And I go, oh, cool. You know, I built that page. They go, oh, yeah, this is really cool. We use it all the time. And so I realized then that I needed to do something with it. So I moved it to a GeoCity server and started to build it out as a real website with banners. If you want to have a good laugh, go to archive.org and type in journalisttoolbox.com, which was the old URL.
I don't know.
You can see what web design looked like in the late 90s. It was pretty rough. You know, I built it out and right after 9/11, you know, so much traffic came in to the site. People were using the resources on deadline. That part of the site is now archived in the Library of Congress, which is kind of cool. All those 9/11 resources. But I realized I needed to turn this into a full .com. I built it out and was selling ads for it. You know, a couple of database companies bought banner ads at the top of it and stuff, and just enough money to, you know, merit my time. I did it as a hobby, basically. And by about 2002, I started to get some interest from some organizations. You know, hey, would you consider, you know, selling it to us and coming and updating it for us? So I did for the American Press Institute. They bought it and ran it from 2002 to 2007. I would update it three or four times a week, and they would push it out over their website and their newsletter. They had an early newsletter and social channels, and they were a great partner. They hit some financial difficulties in 2007. It was right after the housing bubble burst. And they go, we're going to shut it down. And I go, well, let's not shut it down. Let's sell it. So we split the income. We sold it to Society of Professional Journalists, and it was housed there for 17 years until their board decided to defund it last May. And one of the things about the Journalist Toolbox is I own the trademark to it. And that trademark enables me to go off and build something else under that brand. You know, AI was, really starting to boom at the time. So I built journalisttoolbox.ai. I also have a textbook that came out about a month ago called The Journalist Toolbox, A Guide to Digital Reporting in AI. I also have a YouTube channel and a newsletter that comes out every other week, every other Tuesday morning. And it's free. It's a Substack. I find, you know, you need to connect with your audience on multiple levels. This does that. You know, the toolbox basically is an archive of resources for journalists covering various topics. We've got, you know, browser extensions, AI browser extensions that are useful for journalists in there. We've got newsletters on AI that are helpful to journalists. We've got all kinds of different tools in there. Image generators, video editors, yeah. Audio editors, all kinds of really cool toys. But how do you use them? Well, the videos teach you how to use them. And then the newsletter keeps you updated on, you know, all the little breaking nuances going on in the industry right now. And kind of fill in that gap, around the updates and between the training videos. Typically, I'll put up a couple training videos each month. The website's updated daily, even weekends. So at least five or six things are going up on the site every day. There are currently more than 2,000 new AI tools being generated every month. There's no lack of content.
The News Nirvana podcast is made possible by the generosity of Blocks Digital. Blocks Digital empowers content producers to connect with their worldwide audiences at scale and continuously transform to achieve their business goals. Contact Blocks Digital today to learn more about how they can help you thrive. Connect with them at blocksdigital.com.
Yeah, I think the part of that story I think that caught me was when you said you first did it and you were walking through the newsroom and saw them looking at it on their screens. And it just made me think, like, every one of us in the business has done that. Like we've found and bookmarked our sites that we go to for, you know, tips or, you know, like a quick link to get to something, whatever. And it actually made me think, like, I think I might've remembered going to the toolbox after 9/11. Cause I was curious how we should, you know, how should I be leading the team, you know, in our newsroom, and how should we be presenting things?
It was a real eye-opener seeing that, you know, seeing the reporters actually using it. Because I left it up, you know, it was a resource for my students. I just kind of left it up on the web and was off, you know, working, you know, shifts on the news desk and hadn't really, you know, I still updated it here and there. But when I saw that they were using it, I realized that this is a product now. And I've got to, you know, that's a big thing right now in journalism is product thinking in newsrooms, you know, building out products around your news and what you produce. I think that was very early product thinking, although I didn't even know what it was. Right. Back then, too, you didn't have the resources available to you. You didn't have startup incubators. There was no Knight Stanford Fellowship program. A lot of the startup money dried up, because of the dot-com bust in 2000. So I didn't have a lot of venture capital available to me. The other big thing, too, is I really needed to think through how to monetize it. I originally looked at making it, you know, maybe, you know, $10 a year subscription. Well, back in 2000, 2001, you didn't want to type in your credit card number online anywhere. People were terrified of it.
Right.
It's hard to get good security. I would have to pay for a lot of money to have a secure credit card vendor to protect the site.
A lot of people would have a second email address just to do their purchasing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and selling the site really became the best option for me, the most realistic, beyond just selling banner ads and, you know, picking up some beer money here and there.
Well, I'm curious, since it evolved in the way it did, where you started it really for students, but then you realized, hey, all of us, no matter where we're at in the career, are gonna use this kind of a thing. What are you getting from people as you know, what are the things they're asking for more? Are they the same between students and quote unquote pros?
Yeah, the pros ask, you know, a lot of times for applications of tools, like they'll have a story or a problem that they need to deal with. Hey, do you know a good tool that will scrape data for me? Or do you know a good tool that does that? I hear from people that I've done trainings for, you know, years ago and haven't heard from in you know, a decade. They'll send me a note, say, hey, you know, is there a good tool for this or that? And yeah, you know, try this or try that. It's great. You know, I love helping them out. The students, they're, you know, novices as far as journalists and reporters. So they don't understand. They're very good at picking up software and learning software very quickly. But they don't have the depth of knowledge of the content or the storytelling. So I have to kind of marry those two for the students. And then for the pros, they already have, they know what they need to perform on their beat or their, whatever topics they're writing or creating multimedia about. So they just need to kind of learn the tools and the technology behind them, simplify it so they can do it quickly. So it's teaching two different audiences, but I think where they meet in the middle is a lot of times I'll take a new technology and try it out on my students first, see and observe how they're absorbing it. There's a new site that's been out for a little while now called Rolliapp, RolliApp.com. It's an experts database. But one of the things Nick Toso has done with that site is they've worked in some of the technology from InfoTracer. And InfoTracer allows you to track information that's spreading on social channels, who the misinformation spreaders are.
Oh, wow.
It's their spreading. It's a game changer. And I saw a demo of it about 10 days ago. And something I was actually doing this morning was building a little exercise, and I'm going to test it out on my students next week, kind of see how they absorb it. And I'm going to start rolling out in some of my fact-checking trainings in newsrooms around the country.
Wow, that could be huge.
It's a game changer.
Because that's both our biggest fear, right?
Yep.
It's
a very powerful tool, and it's available now. You can sign up for free, rolliapp.com. They're an advertiser on my website, so I full disclosure there. But when they expose that to me, it's a great expert database. You need to find somebody that's an expert on politics or sports concussions or whatever. You can go in and find that. But it's when you dig down to that next level with that InfoTracer, creates graphics with it. But more importantly, it goes back and tracks when the misinformation began to spread, who the main spreaders are, at what platforms. I mean, it's not just Twitter, it's Reddit, Facebook, Threads, all kinds of different social platforms. So I see it as being a real game changer. And Nick's partnership with Information Tracer is a really important one moving forward, especially in an election year, because I'm getting a lot of requests right now for fact-checking trainings with the election. So I'm going to go out on the road pretty soon here. I've been a Google News Lab trainer for the last 7-8 years. And I'm going to be out on the road working with Google to do a lot of the fact-checking trainings in newsrooms.
Well, that was actually going to be my next question, because you've mentioned fact-checking a lot in this conversation.
Yeah.
And it has taken on a new level of importance, right? Like when I started, fact-checking was really, my editor making sure I didn't screw something up. Right? It was really just the extra set of eyes. But we live in a world now with so much information flying around and so many people trying to influence that information. It's not only is it more important than it ever has been, but it's a different kind of fact checking.
It really is. Yeah. Double checking the spelling of the name in the story used to be one of the, the biggest things, and it's still extremely important. But now, one of the things, again, that I teach students is getting back to the root source of something. If you're fact checking something and they, link to or attribute to a piece of data that came from a Chicago Tribune story, I'm like, that's not your root source. Where did the data come from originally? It came from a study, a public record. Let's go back to that root source and confirm it there. And that I think is really the core of what we need to be able to do now, is dig down to that fourth or fifth level and find, okay, where did this fact originate from? That starts too with, fact checking photos. You can use Google reverse image search and many other tools to go back and find where that photo originally was posted on the web. I mean, it's magic. I always tell people that the internet giveth and taketh away. It's created all these opportunities to create misinformation, both through social channels and through, you know, websites in you know, generally on the web. But also you can go back and fact check. It's given us tools that we can go and fact check and you know, disrupt a lot of this misinformation and disinformation that's circulating. I mean, the tools that exist now didn't exist in 2016 when we had the 2016 election. We didn't have Fact Check Explorer. We didn't have a lot of the organizations that were our fact checkers today didn't have them back then. You know, there's PolitiFact and a few others, you know, that were really, you know, breaking ground in that area. You know, one of them that goes way back is Snopes. Snopes goes back to 9/11. There was misinformation spreading like crazy on 9/11, mostly through newsletters and widespread email.
Bulletin boards and newsletters.
Scary stuff, too. And Snopes was out there debunking a lot of that stuff on, you know, September 11th and 12th, 2001. So the concept of fact checking is nothing new. And the misinformation, disinformation goes back centuries, you know, back in the late 1880s, 1780s, really, the pamphlets had headlines that read "Important if true." Fact checking has been around for a very, very long time, and so it's misinformation and disinformation. It's just expanded so much because of the expanse and the immediacy of the web.
You know, we started this conversation having fun talking about sports writers, and talking about how they are. You know, you said such great observers. They're really trained to observe the moment and capture that moment in time. But we just talked about also the importance of being able to do that research component of reporting, to dig in beyond what you just witnessed to get the context of that moment in time.
That's extremely important. What does it mean? I was talking about this just the other day. I sent students out to do a mobile reporting assignment. They can only shoot and produce on their phones. They can't use their laptop or desktop. It's called Chicago GO, capital GO. And they have to go out and shoot around the city. And they got very lucky because we had beautiful weather the past week here in Chicago. Usually this time of year, it's a little rough. But they went out and shot. And one of the big things when we were critiquing them in Tuesday's class was I go, you got to provide the reader context. They don't know where you are. They don't know what you're doing. So posting a cool video, you may do that just on your regular Twitter account for fun. And your friends like it, and that's cool. But for a reader, you've got to really explain to them the basics, who, what, when, where, why, how, and how much, either through the tweet or the social post or in text cards in the video if you're doing just a single photo text card, you need to explain it there. So being able to wrap that context around it, either going through and doing research beforehand, during, and after, having it, embedded somewhere into your story is critical. I had a couple students that did stories on, Gaza ceasefire vote by the Chicago City Council, the largest city council to vote for a ceasefire in Gaza. And I go, well, that's cool. You got some video of it. There were some protesters outside City Hall and in the hallway of City Hall. You captured great footage. I go, but what does that mean? What does that mean to the Chicago reader? What does it mean to UIC? Because they're students on campus too. So one of them actually tied it back to some protests on campus from last semester. The other one tied it to the protesters that were in the lobby, and really began to fold out and give a little more context. Hey, add another slide and talk about how the mayor broke the tie vote. Some didn't have, in sports, you got to put the score in the story in the first three paragraphs. Some of them forgot to put the vote in. It was a close vote. It was a big part of the story. So providing that extra context and just getting back to the basics, who, what, when, where, why, how, and how much. If they can answer those questions in a very concise way through Twitter and through a short social media video, they're going to be able to go out and be very successful in the industry. And we're working with sophomore, junior, and senior level students in this class, in this digital reporting class I'm teaching. And That's a good skill to have. And it's a very hard thing to do. It's a lot more than what was asked of us.
Right.
As freshmen and sophomores in college, you know, sophomores and juniors in college. Yeah. You know, go write a good news lead.
And maybe a camera. Maybe.
Yeah, go write a good news lead. And that's not enough anymore. They need to be able to handle the technology and the fundamentals and marry them together. And two aren't mutually exclusive. That's been a big battle in journalism schools around the country is, oh, well, we don't have time to teach the technology. Yeah, you do. I've got 105 web training videos up on the web. Have the students watch those training videos, you know, outside of class. And then you teach them the journalism, marry the two together. And you've got a student that's ready to go out and work just about anywhere the day they graduate.
Yeah, it makes me think that we should have another episode just about reporting with these. These are amazing tools.
It's a whole chapter in my book too, and I quote Rob Montgomery out of Berlin and Rob Layton out of Australia, who are two of the best cell phone shooters in the country. Montgomery and Layton would be great guests on your show. We'll get to that later, though. They're fantastic people and great shooters. And their point of view on mobile and it's really interesting because Europeans and people in other parts of the world are using it much more here than in the U.S. They've taken it to heart and understand what it can do. Mark Settle at the BBC has trained a whole generation of journalists on how to use these mobile devices and capture high quality storytelling, you know, mini documentary level storytelling.
Well, as we wrap up here, I want to give you a little bit of an opportunity. I like to use this show to push back a little bit on negative talk that we have amongst ourselves and from outside too about the industry. What you're looking at all these tools, you're talking to the next generation of reporters, you're training current ones. What are some things, what are you excited about? What makes you think about the future of our industry that's good, that's going to be great or continue to be great?
I'm really worried about it, to be honest. You know, the layoffs at the LA Times, you know, where I used to work, those cuts, a lot of newsrooms have been deep. You know, Chicago Tribune's had some very deep cuts as well. And I am concerned about it. But I also see things that are, you know, from the ashes shall rise a phoenix. Things like Block Club Chicago, which is a community news website here in Chicago that covers neighborhoods like nobody I've ever seen. And they're becoming sustainable. They're finding a business model that works for them. Chicago Documenters, Daryl Holiday, another guy would be a great guest on your show. What he's built there, you know, training the general public to go out and observe community meetings and document them and write, you know, short summaries of what they see at a community policing meeting or a water board meeting or things like that. So we see these little, you know, bright lights that are shining through the dark cloud of, you know, large corporations and hedge funds. They're just slashing newsrooms to shreds. But there are opportunities out there for young journalists. I was looking, Mandy Hoffmachel, who works for Hearst Media, sends out a little jobs newsletter once a week, every Monday. 10 jobs and a photo of my dog, it's called. And you know, she's got dozens of jobs in there. So there's still opportunities out there. The thing I'm noticing in the job descriptions are things like data journalism, AI skills, and so on. You know, we've got to train them and teach them things that are going to make them employable now. So the opportunities are there. I think we have more options to tell stories in different ways than we ever have had before.
Absolutely.
You know, mobile, data, digital, all of these resources at our disposal, I think are things to get excited about. And it's one of the reasons I wrote the Journalist Toolbox textbook is, you know, newsrooms and journalism schools need this guide to walk them through all these fundamentals that the students need up front. And that's one of the reasons I did it. But yeah, I'm optimistic, but you know, I am concerned about you know, the fact that, you know, some newsrooms are cutting city hall coverage and aren't covering the school board anymore. And there are small towns, you know, there are news deserts all over our country. And that worries me. You know, I started a small weekly newspaper called the Papillion, Nebraska Times. And that little paper meant everything to the people in southwest suburban Omaha, Nebraska. You know, and publications like that are drying up all over the world. Not just the U.S.
I think you can have both feelings. And I think you know, maybe too, seeing those things that are the layoffs and the closings can inspire people to take advantage of all of the tools and the technologies. I love what you said about there are more ways to tell stories now than they have. And I'll say I started doing, you know, podcast type stuff and YouTube shows 6 years ago or so, and it has reinvigorated me. It's a new way to tell stories I had never done, and it's fun.
Yeah, we're working right here on StreamYard, and it's really cool to you know, be working with something that is tailored exactly to what you need it to do. For so long, we've had to kind of jerry-rig different tools to do different things for us. But now it's getting down to the level where they can really fine-tune things to do a specific task for us. And that's what I'm hearing, you know, coming back from the newsrooms. I need something that does just this and only this. I don't need a Swiss Army knife tool that does
right.
I need something that does this one thing. Where do I go?
I've almost become a StreamYard evangelist. It's perfect for what I do.
It's great. Yeah, it's great. I've used it a few times. I have a couple of friends that do a sports talk, a radio show back in Nebraska. So, you know, I jump on it. We're on StreamYard. So really, really, you know, fantastic resource. And I just encourage people to go to journalisttoolbox.ai. It's free. You can dig in there. You can find all these different tools and resources that will work for you. We have a What's New page of updates. I do have a page on there on law and ethics, you know, concerns with AI tools, both legally, you know, copyright, things like that. Where do things stand? We've got a lot of guides up there on best practices, ethical issues that pop up. You know, it's not all, you know, wine and roses out there right now. There's going to be a lot of court cases and a lot of legal haggling, especially over images and video editing and things like that, that are going to emerge. You know, we already see the New York Times case, you know, against Microsoft and OpenAI that are going to really kind of dictate what we're able to do with AI and what we shouldn't be doing with AI over the next 5 to 10 years.
Well, you just mentioned the website they can go to get your newsletter. If people want to follow along, follow you, find you, how can they do that?
Sure. I'm at It's Mike Riley on Twitter, ITS Mike, and then Riley is R-E-I-L-L-E-Y on Twitter, at Journ Toolbox too on Twitter, J-O-U-R-N Toolbox. And really everything's available on the website. My email's up there, forms if you want to submit a website to be considered for the toolbox, that's up there. My training videos are up there. The newsletter, the Substack link is right there. You can subscribe for free or donate if you want to. You know, everybody needs some beer money. There's a lot of different ways you can reach out to me, and I'm always here to help. You know, I never turn down a journalist in need. So,
well, awesome, Mike. I appreciate the time today. I appreciate all the work you're doing for the industry. Thank you.
No, this is fantastic. Thanks for having me on. This was fun. Just to sit around and kind of talk about, you know, that connection over the last 30, 35 years of where we've gone with all this. I mean, when I was a 22-year-old college kid, I had no idea that this is what we would be doing in my late 50s, you know. So it's fun. But thanks for having me so much. And thanks, Cherry, too, for all your work.
I appreciate it, Mike. That'll wrap us up for this episode. We'll talk to everybody next time.
The News Nirvana podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or most any of your favorite podcast apps. The News Nirvana podcast is made possible by the generosity of Blox Digital. Connect with them at BloxDigital.com. The News Nirvana podcast is produced by Fredcasts. Think, speak, act.